This is the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Subscribe at reason.com/podcasts or at Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts. So, how should the United States government and the rest of us peons respond to the coronavirus, which has just been declared a global pandemic by the World Health Organization? It is getting scary out there. Balaji Srinivasan, who was on a short list to head up Donald Trump's Food and Drug Administration, has some strong opinions on the matter. He's a former venture capitalist at Andreessen Horowitz, and he's a serial entrepreneur with a PhD in electrical engineering. The genetic testing company he co-founded, Counsyl, helped change the way millions of people prepare for parenthood, and his cryptocurrency startup, Earn.com, was acquired by Coinbase, where he served as chief technology officer. In a prescient, lively, and constantly updated Twitter feed, Srinivasan has been way ahead of the curve in noting the coronavirus's spread and potential to cause a global public health crisis and a massive economic and social disruption to life as we know it. During a conversation conducted via Skype with me, he talked about why he thinks the coronavirus may have as big an impact on our way of life as the 9/11 attacks did, how the United States government, especially the FDA he once might have headed up, has fumbled its response, and why we're likely looking at mandatory quarantines at the national level. At the same time, Srinivasan also believes that private sector and nonprofit actors are conducting a digital Dunkirk rescue operation that might not only save countless lives, but actually accelerate the adoption of positive forms of decentralization and digital culture in our political, economic, and personal lives. Balaji, thanks for talking.
Hello, Nick.
So let's get right to it. You were really early in sounding the alarm about coronavirus. How did you hear about it, and why were you on top of it? And what does that say about Silicon Valley versus journalists on the East Coast?
So I've been following, you know, the coronavirus out of my peripheral vision as kind of one of many stories until I saw the lockdown on January 23rd. And that was unprecedented. It was an unthinkable signal. You know, the Chinese government, it's completely focused on economic development. So to quarantine millions of people, which would soon become hundreds of millions of people, that made me pay attention to what was going on. And so I began talking to many friends of mine, Chinese engineers, entrepreneurs, angels, and the like. And the qualitative picture that I got from this was hair-raising, right? You know, we're talking videos and photos of people being blockaded in their apartments, right, dying on the street. Even one of a man throwing himself off a bridge because he couldn't get into the hospital. He didn't want to bring the virus home to the family. I didn't know what to believe from this. You know, some of it could be fake. But on the other hand, those images would seem fairly difficult to fake, even with today's technology, and they seem to match the general circumstances. So, you know, even if some of them are true, these were sort of sci-fi movie level events, right, happening in China, right? And if I, you know, was too skeptical, you know, I would remind myself that there was an officially acknowledged scale of the lockdown, which is unprecedented, and that was an independent reference point of ground truth that one could anchor on, right?
Right.
Now, you know, I also have a background in like bioinformatics, molecular diagnostics, genomics, and so on. So, you know, even though maybe a lot of people know me for crypto and venture capital, actually, I did many years as the founder of a genomic testing company prior to getting into crypto and angel and venture. And I was an academic for many years. So the third thing I did is, you know, I dug into the literature and read all the sort of dispassionate medical reports. And you know, these kinds of articles in the New England Journal of Medicine or the Lancet, they're written in a style which is almost like the opposite of clickbait. So like, you know, the first U.S. case study written up in the NEJM said something like, you know, 35-year-old patient with no pre-existing conditions contracted bilateral pneumonia by day 10, we pursued compassionate use. And in English, that means a healthy 35-year-old man was brought to death's door and we need an experimental drug to save his life, right? Now, I mean, zero insult whatsoever towards the folks writing these articles. That's right, accepted style. When you translate them, it's eyebrow raising. You know, basically, you know, here's a healthy 35-year-old about to die, and it took 10 days and a team and an experimental drug to save him. And that was like the first case in the USA, right? And that's a contagious disease. So, you know, you start mapping that to not just one person, right, but to 10 people or 100 people or 1,000 people, that starts to get very expensive in all senses of the term, in terms of suffering and in terms of medical resources and so on. Right? So the combination of A, China's official state action, B, unofficial social media reports from people in China, and C, articles in biomedical journals, that's what made me triangulate on this early as something of potentially critical importance.
So what were journalists missing? What were American health officials? Because the New York Times ran a story this morning about how Seattle, there were a couple people in Seattle who said, look, there's something really big going on here. And then they couldn't really get traction within their own health organizations.
Yep.
But what were journalists and health officials missing?
So I want to say, some professional journalists really got this right. And, I've got like a piece coming on, let's call it corporate journalism versus citizen journalism. And not all corporate journalism is bad. For example, journalists at Caixin in China, they published really impressive stories in the face of state censorship. And, the New York Times, their China reporters, like Amy Quinn and Paul Moser, they did pretty impressive work. There's people on the ground in China who risk consequences from both the government and the virus to get the story out. So I want to kind of level set that, right? But I'd say tech journalists completely failed on the most important story of the year so far, if not the decade. This could be, to the 2020s, what 9/11 was to the 2000s, or the financial crisis to the 2010s, kind of the starting gun that kicks off.
So you're telling me we're in a new decade and it's already kind of in the shitter.
I'm not saying in the shitter, but certainly this is going to be an event that colors this decade. The level of the number of consequences, obviously politically, but for technology, for biotech, for all kinds of things, for immigration policy, so just focusing, for a second, just on the tech angle, right? Tech journalists completely failed on this. And it's not just that infamous Recode article talking about how paranoid VCs were doing handshakes. Now, pretty much every intelligent politician in the world is doing, or the BuzzFeed article saying, don't worry about, coronavirus, worry about the flu. It was the tone of these journalists and all their tweets and whatnot, talking about the terrified, racist, xenophobic bubble boy VCs who were scared to death of this total non-issue of virus, right? And that's all a matter of public record. And of course, this non-issue turned out to be very much an issue. And they weren't simply getting the story wrong, but they were actively attempting to shame and silence the people getting the story right. And some of them, later insincerely apologized. Others wrote, columns about how they got the story wrong in a slightly more insincere way. And then once Trump started adopting their early talking points about how the virus was just the flu, several of them have reversed themselves and pretended, they'd been taking it seriously all along. They were against the virus, before they were for it, or against fighting the virus before they were for it, right? But as a group, I think tech journalists completely just unforgettably failed on the virus crisis in a way I know people, at least within tech, will never forget.
What explains that? Are tech journalists, and we're going to get to the kind of libertarian intersection here. Are they always skeptical about, the great big thing, or is it particular? I mean, because in a way, tech journalists seem to be suckers for certain types of stories, and then they reject others. What would make them more prone to rejecting this story?
No, I mean, like in general, I think it's not that they're skeptical of big things. They're credulous of big things that are negative, against tech companies, and they are skeptical of things that are positive, right? And the reason for it, I think it really boils down to the fact that, another word for a lot of these journalists is they're employees of a media corporation. And those media corporations are direct competitors of tech corporations. And they're direct competitors, certainly monetarily on the back end in terms of advertisers and what have you, but even more importantly on the front end in terms of influence, right? In many different ways, people seek information on Google, they talk to each other on Facebook and WhatsApp, they post on Twitter, in many, many different ways that undermines kind of the information monopoly. And, the counter argument you'll often get is, oh, there's an advertising versus editorial wall in journalism, tech people don't understand this. And of course, that actually exists within tech companies as well. Google has a wall between search engine engineers and advertising engineers. That wall at least existed for many years. But really, it is true that journalists aren't thinking about day-to-day ad sales, but they are hyper-conscious of the fact that the industry is generally declining, that fellow journalists have gotten laid off, and that these, you know, callow tech people seem to be all making millions of dollars. Of course, they focus on the successes, but not the failures.
Right.
So I think certainly part of it is the fact that many of these tech journalists frequently lack technical backgrounds. I mean, there's this amusing thing where folks were like, oh, haha, all these VCs commenting on the coronavirus. And, you know, I had to cock my head because many VCs have biotech backgrounds. That's like, if not half of VC, it's a very large chunk of VC. Founders Fund, Y Combinator, A6Z all have large biotech funds, and biotech in the broad sense, meaning biomedicine, not simply recombinant DNA. So, you know, and then, of course, there's lots of specialist biotech funds. But tech journalists, they lack technical backgrounds. They often, you know, they can't code. They don't know drugs, diagnostics, therapeutics, but they comment. And so certainly part of it is they lack a technical background. I think another part of it is, you know, as you may be aware, many of these tech journalists, they actually grew up rich. They went to private school. They have trust funds or inherited wealth. And they're motivated by a bizarre sort of animus against the nouveau riche tech people. And one way of parsing it is really old money versus new money. And, you know, there's a guy, Antonio Garcia Martinez, who tweeted about this, you know, recently. And a bunch of journalists yelled at him. And then many of them volunteered. One of them volunteered that she had gone to a $90,000 a year private school,
right?
You know, before anybody else.
Wait, so reel that back for a second, though. And how does that map on to missing the coronavirus story?
Great question. It's basically the combination of A, technical ignorance, and B, class hostility curled into a cocktail where they didn't know what they didn't know about the virus, but they did know that they hated these tech interlopers, and that's what drove the coverage.
Okay. So discuss how is coronavirus different than the flu? You know, one of the early stories was, you know, and I think there's a plausibility factor that this is a type of flu, might be a little bit worse, but, you know, let's not lose our shit over this.
Yeah. So let me give a qualitative answer and then a quantitative answer.
Okay.
So on December 1st, Wuhan was a normal city in China, okay? It had its problems, but it was a normal city. Okay. Less than 60 days later, 7 hospitals in Wuhan were filled, according to Caixin. The sick were being sent home to die. China instituted the largest quarantine in recorded history, and basically wartime measures were instituted. Now, that is not a bad flu season. You know, that is something that is on a completely different level. And, you know, you have to think, okay, well, you know, the Chinese government, the Chinese people, there's many criticisms one can give of them, but they're serious people. You know, these are not folks who are known for doing anything like this. They're so focused on economic growth, right? So that right there is a pretty unfakeable signal. And then, you know, I tweeted that, and now later, Iran and Italy have both had very similar kinds of scenarios. So this virus seems to be overwhelming hospital systems, flooding them, you know, with folks with respiratory failure, crashing hospital systems. So that itself is something which is qualitative. Now, the quantitative is when people are comparing this to the flu, they're comparing a constant to a variable. The flu is a known quantity. It's roughly steady state. We know within bounds how many people it's going to infect. A bad flu season does not crash a hospital, right? Whereas this is something which is wildly contagious, has at least on the order of 10x the lethality rate. It has a far higher hospitalization rate than the flu. And, you know, a better way of calling it would be like an aggressive viral pneumonia, right? Because people know the word pneumonia and they know pneumonia is actually serious, right?
So what is your best guess of, you know, the lethality of this? What is it going to be, you know, are we going to have a 1% kind of death rate out of infection overall compared to a 0.1% for the flu? Or
okay, so
does it make sense to talk about it in these terms yet?
All right, so good question. Let me say a few things. First is the so-called case fatality rate, which is the percentage of folks who die from the disease who have been diagnosed with it. It varies a lot between countries. Italy is now reporting like 8%. Okay. Now, why is it so high? Well, Italy, it seems like it's really just killing folks who are 70 or 80 plus. These are also obviously human beings. They're our elders, our parents, our grandparents, or what have you. So it's just extremely dangerous there. Also extremely dangerous in the US, that nursing home, you know, they reported something like, you know, last I saw, something like 26 people out of 120 died. A normal month, it's an acute care home, but in normal month, they said 3 to 7 die. So if you have 26 die, that's an excess of like, you know, 20, 25 deaths, right? Or 20, 23 deaths. So, but the broader point is, let's even say the case fatality rate is 2%. There's a few reasons why that is not low. First of all, if 2% of America died, or if 60% of America got it and then 2% of those died, that is millions of people. Mm-hmm. That is like 1,000x 9/11, right? So that alone, 2% is a very high number in that sense. You know, just completely excess unanticipated deaths out of nowhere. Number two is lots of people, again, WHO stats, have been reported. These will vary a lot. But WHO is reporting something on the order of 20% have serious conditions requiring hospitalization. 20% getting hospitalized, not all of those people are going to bounce back, okay? For example, there's a radiology paper that I cite where, prominent radiologists or let's say credible people at UCLA, USC are basically observing, look, SARS and MERS, there was permanent lung damage there for a substantial fraction of the folks affected by that. It's not necessarily the case. You get COVID-19 and you just, jump out of bed and you're all set if you don't die. There's a continuum. Anything serious enough to put 20% of people in the hospital is going to cause permanent damage to people, probably, at least to some people. Like, think about polio, right? It didn't kill everybody, but right. It did paralyze some people. So that's the second thing is, so first is 2% is actually still a pretty high death rate. Second right. is other folks are going to be permanently injured. And third is quantity really matters. If you had a 2% case fatality rate and this thing was not that contagious, it only infected 1,000 people, yeah, okay, it would not be something that requires the attention of every government in the world. But scale matters. You have something that has the potential, in the absence of dramatic intervention, to scale to millions and then maybe billions of people. Just to show that that's possible, remember the swine flu from 2009? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's a technique called serosurveys, where you actually go and take blood out of somebody's arm. It's not a mathematical model. So there's a paper which went and looked at a bunch of people who'd done serosurveys in different countries. They took blood out of people's arms, they looked for presence of antibodies against H1N1, and they found that about 10 to 20% of people in like a dozen countries had antibodies to H1N1, right? So that's a reproducible molecular assay. That's not a mathematical model, right? What that meant is 10 to 20% of people in the world had gotten swine flu. Now, if you have something like COVID-19, which is potentially as contagious as swine flu, so it can get to that scale of 700 million or 1.4 billion mm-hmm. people, but is far more lethal, that's an extremely dangerous thing. So that's why basically, three reasons that, the fatality rate is actually, or the severity rate is pretty high. Number one, 2% is actually pretty high. Number two, there's potential for long-term illness, because people are getting hospitalized. Number three, the scale is massive. So the sheer number of people flooding into emergency rooms and so on will crash hospital systems. And that, by the way, has second-order consequences. You crash the hospital, and then what happens? Nobody wants to come into the hospital. Why?
Right.
Because you don't want to get COVID-19, right? So all other routine care goes down, right? You had an appendix, and you need to get that removed. That goes down. You just want to get a checkup. Can't do that.
Right.
You want to deliver a baby, all that stuff. So it has second-order effects on mortality and so on in the population. Go ahead.
Okay, so you're making the case that this is a serious issue that really needs mass attention at different levels. Out of the countries so far that you've mentioned, or a couple that we haven't, there's China, there is Iran and Italy have been hardest hit by most yep. accounts. It's obviously in the U.S. and we're going to be seeing numbers doubling and the doubling cube going up. South Korea has talked about having effectively contained it, it seems, or at least according to some of the reports coming out of there. What countries are doing well in dealing with this, and what countries are something that we really need to avoid?
So it looks like in this kind of first round that Asian countries, I wasn't sure what to make of China's posted decline, like mm-hmm. a week or so ago. But now that South Korea, Taiwan, and it looks like Singapore, Malaysia potentially are getting this under control, it looks like it is possible to halt the spread through China-like measures of lockdown, quarantine, and so on and so forth, right?
Okay, and by that and so on and so forth, let's including kind of enforced social distancing, which
yes.
seems to come up again and again, of just having not only having people stay out of the workplace, stay out of big meeting places, but then, not getting too close to each other when they're walking around the street.
That's right. And I think the other countries that I think have done reasonably well, so Estonia, mm-hmm. not a surprise, competent country. Israel, I think, has done a pretty good job of it
right.
so far, right? And it, generally the countries that, Israel, Singapore, Estonia, these are smart countries with serious people, right? Right. I haven't looked at Dubai's numbers, but I wouldn't be surprised if they're doing reasonably well. Yeah.
So they're smart countries with serious people, et cetera. There are also a lot of them are either very authoritarian or much more authoritarian than the U.S., including a country like Israel, which, for a variety of national security reasons, people there put up with a much more invasive day-to-day presence of the state. You're a libertarian. I mean, you're one of the kind of libertarian visionaries for this horrible decade that has just been started. How do you feel about that kind of stuff? Or, I don't believe you to be an anarchist or anything. I'm certainly not. But, how do we know that this is the time where you say, okay, you know what, we do have to cede extra control to the state for a certain period of time, or is this just the beginning of a lockdown that really never gets relieved?
So I want to, in a very polite way, contest the premise. I wouldn't actually.
Don't have to be polite, by the way.
No. I understand why you thought of that premise, but I would actually not call myself a libertarian. And I think I've actually been consistent about that over the years. I'm sympathetic to certain libertarian concepts and ideas, but here's my mental model, and I tweeted about this or what have you. I think the ideal is a competent centralized government, which you can effectively sign the social contract with, the terms of service, by immigrating there. So you immigrate to Israel, you immigrate to Singapore, and by immigrating there, you're effectively, just like, you sign up for Facebook, you sign up for Google, there's terms of service. And if you don't like them, you at least have the back button, you can leave, and you're not mandated to it. But now, that's not completely ideal because there's Facebook pixels, Google pixels that will track you across websites. It's not that easy to opt out of non-ideologies there. But let's say at a high level, you can make that analogy, right? If you enter the society, you're kind of signing this contract. If not, you're not. So a competent centralized government, for example, I personally would prefer not to own a firearm. I personally prefer a government that controls crime to an extent that I can actually trust in that government to protect my family and property and what have you. And I think Singapore is like that, Now, with that said, if the best is a competent centralized government, the worst is a malicious centralized government like the USSR, like Cuba or North Korea or what have you. And then, not quite as bad as that, but certainly quite bad, is an incompetent centralized government, as distinct from actively malicious. And of course, there's gradations of that, okay?
Yeah, but absolutely.
But let's say where the US is right now, right? At city, state, and federal levels, we have not seen phenomenal leadership on the coronavirus crisis. And in fact, we haven't seen phenomenal leadership in quite a while. You can argue that, the peak of the USA was roughly bracketed by 1933 and 1968. So 1933, Hoover Dam, 1945, Manhattan Project, 1968, Apollo. That was a period of peak centralization when the US government actually got a lot of the technical talent and was able to build and ship big things. And before and after that period, you actually have the technical talent. And I'm not saying technical talent is everything, but it's a lot. You had the technical talent, before that era, the quote robber barons and, captains of industry who are building railroads and aviation, the Wright brothers, all those kinds of people. Then afterwards, you have all the tech CEOs and investors and hedge fund folks to some extent and whatnot. So what's my point? My point is, while the best is a competent centralized government and the worst is a malicious government, and the second worst by a big jump, but still bad, is an incompetent centralized government, in between a competent and an incompetent centralized government is the decentralized response.
So what are the best elements of the decentralized response, and how much of that is coming from non-governmental agencies? So, how important are the... Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So when I say the decentralized response, certainly very specifically, it's things like the Gates Foundation working with Wellcome and MasterCard to go in. Wellcome Trust, actually, it is a government-funded organization in part. The Gates Foundation putting up money to fund at-home tests because the state is failing, right? But it's not just decentralized medicine. It is decentralized media because... for example, at least a big chunk of the centralized media failed here. Tech journalism failed. And I call it centralized, by the way, in the sense that it's culturally centralized. Even though it's 10 or 20 different outlets, they all work at each other's kind of things. And they're all in the same social network, right? So you have decentralized medicine, decentralized media. This virus crisis is going to become a financial crisis if it isn't already. A ton of money is going to be printed. So you're going to need decentralized finance. Brings us back to crypto. You need decentralized preparation because your city or state is probably going to say nothing to see here until suddenly the tsunami descends upon it, right? And that's what I mean by the decentralized response is in, while I'd prefer a Singapore or an Israel or an Estonia, which is actually capable of taking care of these things, essentially as a service provider, I pay that government and they take care of stuff for me in the same way that, I don't have to think about, my Dropbox, right? I pay Dropbox. Mm-hmm. If that is not the case, then I still want to be able to do it myself. And that's where the decentralized response comes in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And in this model, the blurring of private and public is kind of blurred in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I think a lot about is the reason that I support, you can make a high level difference between, let's say, principled and pragmatic libertarian leaning people, mm-hmm. right? The principled libertarians are against something on a matter of principle, right? That is to say, even if, let's take quarantine as actually a good example. They are for exit because to them, the rights of the individual are paramount, even if it's actually worse for society and the individual, right? And I don't mean worse in a theoretical way. I mean worse in a die of a contagious virus kind of way, right? A pragmatic libertarian, though, is basically someone who's here's a utility function of some kind. We should support the policies that maximize that utility. For example, Singapore in general has fairly free markets. They're fairly pro-free trade, but they don't hesitate to kind of step in and put a thumb on the scale if necessary. Just for example, they actually did put price controls on top of masks and they issued a bunch of free masks to deal with this crisis, right? Mm-hmm. And I very much, at least personally, I put myself in that second camp of the pragmatic because, the goal is human flourishing and that doesn't mean being rigidly ideological, in my view.
Right. Do you think, with something like, putting price controls on, it could be breather masks, it could be hand sanitizer, it could be any number of things. Does that actually work in America? I mean, on a level of pragmatics.
So I mean, the thing about it is, let's say there's kind of three levels of doing something, right? Let's take, price controls. Level one is the really dumb. Oh, let's put price controls because we hate these corporations. They're trying to chip people and so on. Level two is the smart version, which is actually if you impose price controls, it's going to cause shortages. And that's going to be a problem because these manufacturers, in a time of huge demand, won't have the capital to go and purchase more. Right. Level three is for the maintenance of social stability in a panicky time, we will do something like impose price controls, but also otherwise subsidize manufacturers on the back end to go and purchase more masks, right?
So talk a little bit of, and when I say I understand, I don't necessarily agree, but I'm interested in kind of fleshing out this, this picture of how government and other parts of society work in a crisis situation. A bunch of, you mentioned before, second and third order health effects and kind of things that will show up down the line. Right now, the Trump administration and Congress, I think you alluded to it before, we're going to see some kind of massive stimulus project here in order to hopefully quiet the markets or to make people think that everything's not going down the drain. What are the types of stimulus projects, if you think they should be, there should be, what are the types of things that you think would work and what do you think are going to be counterproductive?
So let me say that basically, to extend, I think it was a Rothbardianism, he said war is the health of the state, right?
Right. More I think it's actually Randolph Bourne.
Okay, but, fine.
I didn't know that he got it from.
So, crisis is the health of the state. And in many ways, I think, you can kind of slot in pandemic as being an even more severe version of many of the debates we've had on terrorism over the last 20 years. And then, then crime goes to like a less version of that. And each of those, as you go up the scale from crime to terrorism to pandemic, you start giving government powers to constrain law-abiding people, in ways, that normally you wouldn't agree with, right? Because the threat goes so high, right? Like with a pandemic, you're talking about basically putting 11 million people in jail without any probable cause, you know, or at least house arrest, right? So, you know, the tricky part about this, I'm not saying I have all the, you know, ethical answers or what have you, but in late January, I was wrestling with this because, frankly, while I thought, you know, I'd certainly known, you know, a pandemic was a possibility, you know, this is kind of, we're in like sci-fi territory at this point. You know, this is something which I would have considered. Have you described the current scenario to me back in November? I would have said, look, you know what? Yes, that's a challenge to the theory of exit as prime, but why don't we cross that bridge when we come to it, right? Now that bridge has been crossed, so we have to come to it. What are the philosophical issues at play, right?
Yeah.
So here's a few things I would say. First is, you know, Ben-Gurion had a really good mental framework before Israel became independent. There's a time when, you know, there was a white paper that the British had issued that he disagreed with. And it essentially opposed, you know, independence of Israel and what have you. But at the same time, they were allied with the British to fight the Nazis. So he had one liner where he said, we shall fight the white paper as if there is no war. We shall fight the war as if there is no white paper. Okay. Meaning that while they would argue vociferously against the white paper, they wouldn't undermine the British in their fight against the Nazis. And while they would ally with the British against the Nazis, they would not give up their aspirations for independence at some point. Right? Mm-hmm. Makes sense? He recognized that these two goals were, in a sense, incompatible in certain ways. Nevertheless, he managed to successfully achieve because they defeated Nazis and they got it, right? You know, like over time. It took a few years, but it worked, right? So that's kind of how I think about this. You know, from the utilitarian standpoint, there's no point in freedom if you're dead, in the sense of I understand live free or die, but and I agree with it in many ways, but die, I'm not sure if I have a pithy one line on it, but you know, like just randomly dying from a virus that you could prevent for some sacrifice of freedom for a little bit of time does not seem to me to be a good trade-off from a utilitarian standpoint, right?
One of the other questions about a lot of this stuff is, you know, Robert Higgs, the economic historian who wrote a book called Crisis and Leviathan, talks about how, you know, and it's very much in the ballpark that we're talking about here, that the state looks at a crisis, it asserts certain types of power, it flexes out. When the crisis has passed, you know, the power doesn't go away. It stays some part of it or all of it. So how do you guard against that? Because we have been seeing, you know, whether in terms of economics, whether in terms of certainly surveillance and certain types of national security things for all of this 21st century, a flex by government, whatever is coming down the line, how do we make sure that the government gives back most of the power that it builds up in itself?
So this is actually, I think I tweeted something like this. I feel that I got it right. I mean, we'll see. But I think I got it right early on because it reminded me a lot of the post 9/11 period. So what I tweeted on February 3rd was, you know, like sometimes a solution creates the next problem. My rough forecast of the future, the coronavirus results in quarantines, nationalism, centralization, and this may actually work to stop the spread. But once under control, states will not cede their powers, so we decentralize.
Right.
And so my answer is, I'm not sure you can work within the system to take away powers once they've been granted. I also don't think that you should undermine, you know, like quarantines that, you know, could, you know, go and spread a deadly virus to lots of people because then you're just screwing everybody, right? However, to reconcile those two incompatible things, just like Ben-Gurion and the white paper and the war, I think the answer is we make the hard choice to work with the quarantines and so on in the present day, sacrifice some freedom in order to, you know, like quell the virus. And then we work on decentralized technologies like decentralized medicine and other kinds of things to enable people to prepare in the future more easily, especially if they're in regions where the government is incompetent.
Let's get to that, what the decentralization will look like in a second, because that I'm actually more interested in because, you know, the crisis is upon us and things are going to happen. Yep. But when we talk about quarantines, can we be more specific? New Rochelle, New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo here in the state of New York has created a containment area of about a mile radius in diameter in New Rochelle, New York. It doesn't mean that people aren't allowed to leave their house. It doesn't mean that they can't go to grocery stores, and et cetera. But the National Guard is there to bring food to people who can't get out otherwise, to clean up stuff, et cetera. When we're talking about quarantines in America, what are we talking about? And what is acceptable? What's an acceptable quarantine, well, you know, currently? Or and how does that change?
So the containment zone is basically, on a 1 to 10 scale, I'd give it like a, I guess, a 2. Because at least it's directionally in the zone of, okay, we need to do something to contain this thing. Right. However, there's many problems with it. First is, it's pre-announced by 2 days. So it's like, you know, like that's exactly what happened with Wuhan. All these people fled. Right. It happened in Italy. All these people fled. So,
but it's also, that's understandable too, right? And it, particularly in an authoritarian regime, people in Wuhan knew what was coming. And they're like, I'm getting the fuck out of here because if I present to the government, you know, I don't know if I'll ever come back. It is
something where, like, this is, it is essentially, here's one way of thinking about it. This is like a wartime scenario in the sense of, you know, if you talk about like the anarchist minarchist division, right? You know, the minarchist is like, okay, the state has legitimate powers in terms of crime and punishment and war, right? And if you think about this, it's kind of like the world is being invaded by a virus, right? Not by the Germans or the Russians or what have you, but by a virus. And that virus is non-compliant with regulations, has no budget, it's completely decentralized, its objective is to kill you and to spread, you know, like it's committing murder all the time, right? And so in those cases, like, you know, if you're fighting a war, you unfortunately, like, somebody has to make greatest good for the greatest number of decisions. Does, you know, and there's sometimes those are zero-sum decisions. One person does have a downside in order for others to have an upside or vice versa, right? And in the case of Wuhan, for example, I absolutely understand why somebody from there wanted to flee. It was in their interest, if they weren't sick, to get outside this quarantine zone, which they might get sicker, you know, even if they were healthy. On the other hand, you also understand why the people outside do not want people from Wuhan to flee, because they didn't want that, you know, sickness come to them. So that, unfortunately, is just a diagonally disaligned kind of thing. The win for one is a loss for the other, and vice versa. There's no obvious win-win there other than maybe some compensation for people in the quarantine zone, which is what Iceland is doing, by the way, like paid quarantine, right? And that might be a smart thing to do, by the way. You know, you give some social credit, some payback. It's not fully compensatory, but maybe partially so, you know? The thing is descending on us so quickly that people haven't thought through things like that. But, you know, one thing also to preempt, by the way, some people will quote that, you know, quote, like, those who give up some freedom for a little security deserve neither. On the other hand, that's also, I don't think it's pragmatic in the sense of, you know, the counter argument, another American quote is, you know, freedom isn't free, right? Meaning that some sacrifice is required. And, you know, that I think that is also true. You know, you don't build a society without some things like that. Let's come back to your original point, though. So you're talking about how should we think about mandatory quarantines, right? And I think, you know, and especially let's take the New Rochelle example. I think America is managing to do things in the worst way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. Here's why. Because the containment zone is not a quarantine. It gets people to flee. It's pre-announced. It is, so if you're doing it, you do it. You know, like you actually... Right. Quarantine in place and you stop people from leaving. It's not an optional thing. If you announce it, then people think, oh, it might become mandatory. Let me get out before that happens. And you actually accelerate the distribution of the virus. It's like bursting spores.
Right.
You know, you push them out, right? So that's actually like the worst of the three options. Don't do it, or pre-announce it and then do it. That third one is actually one that spreads the most.
So what, I mean, are you, would you recommend, or how do you recommend, and it's interesting to talk to somebody who is, you know, seriously, you know, in line to be the FDA commissioner, where, you know, and we can talk about, you know, the way in which the FDA and the CDC and whatnot are either doing well or bad, but like, would you go to, you know, where would you say, okay, we're having a mandatory quarantine, or is it everywhere in the country? I mean, the Lombardy region of Italy, you know, the industrial powerhouse of Italy is under a form of quarantine. I mean, are we telling people not? Yeah. Okay. So do we say nobody's leaving the country, nobody's coming in, or if they're coming in, they have to be, you know, quarantined for a couple of weeks before they're allowed to go to their final destination?
I mean, I think that's probably what's going to happen because basically, you know, something that was a preventable thing, we've had a cascading failure where basically we're flying blind. Thanks to the CDC's case definitions, thanks to the FDA's CDRH division impeding emergency use authorizations for all these labs and bottlenecking testing during a critical period in February. Thanks to all of that, basically everybody was, and still is in some ways, in a sense of kind of complacency. They thought, you know, oh, it's being contained. You know, Trump's been tweeting, oh, it's only so many cases. Actually, it's probably more like 10,000 plus cases, you know. And the reason I get that estimate is when Trevor Bedford, prophet UW, finally was able to get some sequence data out of these viruses, two viral strains, he'll estimate that in Washington alone, there's likely an outbreak of size 570. That was like a week ago, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and almost certainly there's like 10,000 plus in the US, and we're going to mm-hmm. find all. And so what I think is going to happen is we've traded the de facto decision by the FDA and CDC but FDA in particular to not approve diagnostics has meant that our indicator is going to be deaths, mm-hmm. right? And hospitalizations. We're going to only take this seriously once we basically disabled our early warning system. And so we're only going to take it seriously when just a bunch of people start piling up in emergency rooms, which is happening, by the way, in you know, Washington and California.
When will we know that the infection has peaked?
We'll know that it's peaked when we have massive diagnostic capability. And I'm talking like hundreds of thousands or millions of tests a day, right? Because it's an infectious disease, right? So testing somebody once is not sufficient. You may need to retest them multiple times. So we need an absolutely massive diagnostics effort, number one. And because, you know, the thing is, it's not how many cases you have, it's how many cases you have and how many tests you ran to determine that. If you didn't run a lot of tests, then you're like, you know, the person looking for the quarter under the lamppost, right? So we'll only know it's peaked if we have massive diagnostic testing capability. We're tracking new cases per day really rigorously across the country. And then we're seeing that peak come down.
And you don't see I mean, it's kind of fascinating to talk to a kind of prophet of decentralization. And we're effectively doing a decentralized response in the U.S. because different states, different localities are doing all sorts of things. The federal government is largely, you know, it's only getting its act together now.
Right.
The private sector, the nonprofit sector is doing stuff. But that's a big mistake for this particular situation.
Yeah. I mean, the decentralized response is better than nothing, but it is significantly worse than a competent centralized government.
Yeah.
And one way of thinking about it is if you bucket this into the national security category, you know, that's a minarchist would agree this would fall into security. It's something that's like an invasion of the country by a virus, right? You know, so what I think is going to happen, or let's say what I think is possible, okay, just given what's happened in other places, given what's happening in New York, I think it's possible that blue cities get quarantined by red troops. Okay.
That should end well, right?
You know, that's what we're on track for, unfortunately. I hope we avoid it. Okay.
So this is the full Omega Man scenario, right? I was the 1971 Charlton Heston movie where some kind of chemical bomb wreaks mayhem and turns people into hippies, actually, albino hippies.
Okay.
And Charlton Heston is one of the last regular people left. But people are put under lockdown. It's martial law. You can be shot if you are seen wandering around the streets after a certain point. I mean, that's essentially what you think is the response that is necessary.
The issue is, I don't think that America is capable of properly calibrating a response. Okay. So it's either apathy or it's going to be this incredible bureaucratic overreaction, which is going to be essentially an internal TSA.
Let's talk a little bit about the ways in which the coronavirus is forcing us or may force us to rethink things, or if we're smart about it, we'll actually come up with new ways of doing things. You talked recently in a tweet about how TSA, you're saying we're going to be going through an internal TSA for the entire country. You talked about how actually the way TSA screens things now is exactly the wrong way to do things. Can you expand a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, well, first of all, it's not hygienic. They are basically patting people down. That I don't know if you've seen these. Of course you've seen them, but at airports, checkpoints where you've got the conveyor belts, these buckets that you put stuff in, they're filthy because people put their shoes in them. It's awful, right? And so it's literally just this.
It's a salad bowl, to mix together to make sure, like, if you didn't have something, you know, if you come in clean by the end of when you're picking up your shoes, you're dirty as hell.
That's exactly right. And I mean, especially coming out of SFO, like, you know, SFO streets are not the cleanest.
I flew out of there like 2 days ago or a week ago. So thank you for the reminder. Right. But yes. Yeah.
So what I think you could replace that with, you know, especially given that these three TSA agents have come up, you know, positive for the coronavirus and probably patting people down at San Jose. I think you just abolished, I mean, in an intelligent country, in a competent country, if you felt that you still had to screen for things, okay? Because, yeah, it's possible someone gets a gun or a knife on a plane. I probably, as a consumer, want some form of screening for that.
Sure.
Even that terrorism is a real thing. Do Amazon go for that's completely feasible today. Josh Wolf and Matt Oko tweeted about it. It's basically like non-invasive scanning that'll just detect whether or not you have the guns or whatever. I mean, the imaging is there for that. And then no agents, no one touches you or whatever. And you can even use thermal cameras and potentially other kinds of sensing to determine does someone have a fever or what have you. That's what they're doing in China. Now, like, will the US actually do that? I'm skeptical. Maybe in like smart regions, but I don't know.
Can we talk about other areas? You know, you have talked over the years about kind of decentralization of things like the workplace and whatnot, or the workforce. Are there ways in which, you know, and I don't want to be as ridiculous as kind of making lemons out of, you know, a pandemic virus or something like that, but, you know, people are being told, okay, if you can work from home, you know, disperse yourselves kind of reliably.
Sure.
What are some of the positive ways that we can take this moment to think about redoing, you know, certain kinds of social, economic, political organization that we take for granted that probably is not particularly efficient or useful for this point in time anyway?
That's a good question. So I think one analogy would sort of be, you know, in World War II, women went to work. And then and they went to work as a wartime measure, but afterwards there was a new normal, right? And women were now in the workforce and it was just a different thing, right? And by analogy, I think, you know, one of my friends said something like, 2020 is the year the future historians will write, the internet actually began, right? Or like this century actually began, because we're basically in a chaotic way, we're doing like I tweet about this, like a digital Dunkirk evacuation, right? Retreat to the cloud to escape the lightning offensive of the virus. You know, so you're just kind of like retreating to the cloud. And the thing about that is we're turning the cloud into like the primary place we are conducting work and other kinds of things, because there's a whole new argument for using, you know, internet technology. That argument is hygiene, right? The remote argument for hygiene, I mean, that shifts something that was happening already into something that is the default way to do it. Like by default, for example, you want touchless faucets, right? By default, you want remote capable jobs. By default, you want autonomous taxis and so on and so forth, because it's more hygienic. And this stuff was already happening, but that adds like 20 or 30 points of population support for it. So it's going to accelerate a ton of things like that. That is a silver lining for this.
Yeah, I love the idea of a digital Dunkirk. I think that really gets at a lot of what's going on, and also what might actually be truly useful and kind of path breaking going forward. Can you talk a bit about is there a generational element to all of this? I mean, and there is clearly, in the sense that if you're over 70, you are much more likely to die. You know, the baby boom generation, and I guess the last remnant of the the silent generation. I mean, they're being pushed off the stage. This seems to, in a weird way, be kind of accelerating that in terms of kind of cultural, economic, political power. We're almost certainly witnessing, I would like to believe that we're witnessing the last presidential election where it's all about, you know, various people who are close to 80 years old. But what, you know, is there a generational thing going, or how does the generational split, which seems to be growing significantly in America, you know, on a daily basis, how is that influencing or intersecting with the coronavirus?
Well, so it's certainly, I mean, one thing that's definitely the case is all of these politicians are in the maximum danger area for the coronavirus. And yet they're still shaking hands, they're still at rallies and whatnot. It's actually mind-blowing to me. I don't even understand it.
Oh, well, and they can't not do it, right? Because if they don't do it, then they look weak and that they're about to die. If they do do it, you know, they might get infected and actually die. So
I guess so. But I mean, like, you know, the thing is, that
tough to be them.
Yeah, there's certainly, I think, a way to phrase this in terms of leadership. And maybe you start holding digital rallies and do Periscopes right. and stuff like that. You know, you can actually, it's actually easier to hold a larger crowd. Guess what? You know, they can all just connect live. You don't need a venue. You can just hold it every single day, a massive rally with a million people, right? So I think what's going to happen is things that were previously fully offline, like rallies, conferences, K-12, education, healthcare, stuff that sort of resisted the internet, we're all going to be forced into rallies, digital conferences, online education, telemedicine, all of those kinds of things. The areas of, you know, like, for example, remote legislation, that's going to come, right? All these areas that have previously proved resistant to the internet are now just getting uprooted from the ground and pulled into the cloud. And people are going to be forced to operate that way for a while. And, you know, that has some salutary, I mean, in the short term, that's chaotic. It's going to cause a lot of dislocation and so on. It does have salutary long-term benefits because we basically learn how to modernize certain areas that have proved resistant to that over the years.
All right. I think we're going to leave it there. That's a good note to end on. We've been talking with Balaji Srinivasan about the coronavirus and, how do we live in a borderless world with a borderless virus. So Balaji, thanks for talking.
Thanks. Yep. I think the borders will come back with this, but we'll borderless on the internet. So.
All right.
Cool.
I hope so.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please go to Apple, Google, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spotify, or Reason.com/podcast to subscribe to this show and Reason's other great podcasts, The Reason Roundtable and the SOA Forum Debates. Thanks for listening.